Good morning, everyone. And I join with you in a vocal expression of the applause that we've all had to our young people. That was a fantastic bit of nativity action. Didn't they? Let's give them another round of applause. It was marvellous. That was great. And we'll have to reassure all the very young ones who are still upstairs that what a blessing it was to be here for that. Now, I must make a confession to you, my dear friends, that I'm not always a really lovely person. I know you find that hard to believe. But there have been times in my life when I have leapt to conclusions, and those conclusions have been incorrect. A great example, and one that I might have told you if I've chatted to you about my most embarrassing swimming incidents in the past, was when I was at the pool, and we had a very simple system in Norwich. You swam in a straight line if there was one person in the pool in your lane. You swam in a straight line if there were two people in the lane. You divided it in two. And if three or four or more people got in the lane, then you all had to swim in a circle. And I hate that, because you end up with one big arm. You're swimming in a circle, so this arm's just trailing, and this arm is doing all the work. So you want to avoid that at all costs. And I arrived, and I stood at the end of a lane, and there was just one woman in it swimming in a circle. So as she stopped at one end, I smiled and said, "Excuse me, do you mind if we split the lane down the middle and swim in a straight line?" And she looked at me and smiled, nodded, and then just carried on swimming in a circle. And I thought, ah, typical. She's doing it to spite me. And I got in that pool and I swam up and down, thinking bad thoughts. And then as we stopped at one end and she was getting out, I said, with perhaps a little hint of sarcasm, "Well, have a good day. Thank you very much." And she took off her swimming hat and turned round and said, in a very broken form of speech, "I'm sorry, I'm deaf. I'm profoundly deaf." And she couldn't understand or hear me. And I felt awful that I had thought ill of this lovely lady. My goodness, I leapt to a conclusion. It was completely the wrong one. Lord, forgive me. And I hope you can forgive me as well. What a terrible person I am. I still have guilt. But you know, it's a very human thing to do. You leap to conclusions. You draw conclusions about people, about situations. We all do it as human beings. We look for patterns. We look for reasons for the way the world around us is the way it is. That's what we do. And people often leap to the wrong conclusions. This passage that Fiona shared with us, which is the excerpts about Elizabeth from the beginning of Luke, has got occasion after occasion of dear Elizabeth being misinterpreted, being misunderstood, ill perhaps being thought of her, where there is none. And what this passage does in such a marvelous way is it provides an understanding for us of what it means to have a living faith. This is what Elizabeth has. She has got a living and a dynamic faith. It is demonstrated time and again in her actions. It is an example for us. And the people misinterpreting her, the people thinking ill of her, and treading on her toes, actually they're doing us a favor. They're providing us with a dark background on which the light of living faith can shine even more brightly. And that's a wonderful thing. So they're really doing us a favor, even though they're probably doing themselves not many favors. So let's have a look at this living faith, and let's see some things that we can learn about it in our own lives and try to foster it in our own lives. Now, in ministry, I've come across quite a few couples who have got married and who have desperately wanted to have children and who have been unable to have children. It is something that happens a lot when you gather together as a big group of people. You meet couples who are in that situation. There are a huge number of different reasons as to why couples can't have children. The range is vast. And there's a huge number of different ways in which people feel about this and respond. People have this great range of emotions where these things are concerned. And you have to be very careful and very sensitive to not offend and upset people. The one thing we can say about Elizabeth and her husband Zechariah is that we have no idea how they felt. We know one thing from the story. We know that they were praying about this situation. We know that they had sought God and that they longed for a child in prayer. But people around them, we discover, thought ill of them. They did something that people often did in those days. They assumed if there's something wrong, there must be a reason for it. There has to be a reason. God must be in some way punishing them. Do you remember a few years ago? It was, let me make sure I've got the date right, in 1999 and actually also in 1998. Glenn Hoddle, he was in charge of the England football squad, and he went on Richard and Judy, and he said something which astounded everyone. He said, "I think that children who are born disabled must have done something wrong in a past life. And then in this life, they come back and they're being punished for it." The nation gasped. Richard and Judy were less than pleased. Tony Blair, then the Prime Minister, intervened and said, in his opinion, he should no longer be the England football manager. It's a shocking thing to say. What he displayed was an attitude that, thank goodness, is something that is very, very rare today. In many circles. Not in all, but in many. But what Glenn Hoddle did was demonstrating an attitude that was very like the attitude of ancient times. Something's wrong, there's got to be a reason. There's got to be, in some way, shape, or form, a reason that the blame sits with you. But we are told emphatically that this was not the case for Elizabeth and for Zechariah. Listen to these words again. It says that Elizabeth was a wife from the daughters of Aaron. That both Elizabeth and Zechariah were righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord, but they had no child. The statement is clear. There is no blame to be apportioned to them. So living faith, how does it deal with this? Living faith, I put it to you, perceives a plan and a purpose. It perceives a plan and a purpose to what is going wrong. It doesn't just say, it's my fault. It doesn't turn round and say, I'm under some sort of a curse. It says those brave and astounding words, I don't understand, but I truly believe God does. And that is an important thing. Crucially important thing for us to reflect on. The next thing that I want to mention is this. I want to look at verses 24 and 25. Look at your little sheet of paper and let's read them again. It says, after these days, his wife Elizabeth conceived, and for 5 months she kept herself hidden, saying, thus the Lord has done for me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach among people. This is something that is extremely strange. And I wonder, as you've read this passage, and no doubt heard it over many, many years of going along to churches or listening to services or listening to lessons of carols and nine readings and all of these different things, I wonder if you've ever actually stopped and noticed this comment that Elizabeth keeps herself hidden, first of all, for 5 months and then very possibly for 9 months. Why on earth would you do that? Again, it's easy to think ill of Elizabeth. It's easy to stop and think that her reasoning behind this might not be the most positive thing in the world. But I want to say to you all this morning, I think that this is right at the kernel of the story of Elizabeth. I think this is one of the most important things that we can take from the account. And I want you to really think about it and reflect upon it. Why does Elizabeth hide for probably fully 9 months? Maybe she's afraid that she won't carry the baby to term. Despite the miraculous surroundings, she has doubts. She thinks to herself, the people already view me with reproach because of my barrenness. If I announce pregnancy and then in some way this pregnancy fails, the reproach will be colossal. Maybe that is her thinking. That's her reasoning behind it. She's afraid something will go wrong. I would suggest that's not the case. If you read all about Elizabeth, she seems to be utterly confident that the blessing of God is upon her and that things will be fine. I don't believe that she is doing that. Another suggestion is this. Perhaps Elizabeth is furious with her neighbours. Their treatment of her and Zechariah has been downright unfair. They have, as is suggested by the passage, seen the predicament they are in and thought that it was something to do with them not being holy or good in some way. Maybe she's so angry with them she thinks, I don't want you to have an ounce of the joy that I'm enjoying now. This is not for me to share with you lot. I'm keeping it all to myself. Again, I suggest that the passage does not back that up as a reason for why she hid herself. Look at verses 57 and 58. It says, when the time came for Elizabeth to give birth, and she bore a son, and her neighbors and her relatives heard that the Lord had shown great mercy to her, they rejoiced with her. She immediately welcomes them in a very open and friendly way. I don't think she's being spiteful. In fact, I'm certain she isn't. We've just heard that she's righteous, blameless, faithful. Spiteful doesn't go into that mix. People who are righteous before God, people who are described as blameless, people who are described as faithful, are rarely petty-minded and spiteful. This doesn't sound like Elizabeth at all. I put it to you that Elizabeth herself explains exactly why she hides, and that this is very, very important. Look at verse 25. It's just gripping. Thus the Lord has done for me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach among people. And just before it says, for 5 months she kept herself hidden, saying, thus the Lord has done for me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach from the people. So what's happening, I believe, is this. She is hiding herself, and she is explaining why she's hiding herself in these words. She's saying, because God's done that for me too. And that, I believe, is the key to this beautiful living faith of Elizabeth. She is embodying what God has done. She perceives that in the midst of reproach, in the midst of not being able to have the child that she wants, in the midst of all the difficulties that she faces in her life, that God has hidden her. She has remained safe and hidden with her Lord God. And this new news, this revelation, hasn't made her change her mind. It's increased that. She feels an enormous sense of closeness to God, and she embodies it physically by taking herself away to be in solitude, in human company, but closely with God. Listen to these words from the Psalms. Psalm 17, verse 8. Keep me as the apple of your eye. Hide me in the shadow of your wings. Psalm 31 and verse 20. In the cover of your presence, you hide them from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter from the strife of tongues. Psalm 64 verses 2 and 3. Hide me from the secret plots of the wicked, from the throng of evildoers who whet their tongues like swords, who aim bitter words like arrows. The Lord hides his people. He hides the faithful. And I believe Elizabeth, in hiding, is embodying what she feels God is doing with her. And I think that is a truly remarkable thing. You see it throughout God's word. Ezekiel does it as well. He does specific things that embody God's messages to his people. It's a very, very fascinating thing that Elizabeth is doing. And what happens when she does that? What happens when she embodies her relationship with the Lord? When she takes herself away? When she hides? Just as the Lord is hiding her in the shadow of his wings, God himself comes to visit in the womb of Mary. That is God's response to this faithful woman, this woman with a living faith, who takes herself away and hides herself in his presence and in the shadow of his wing. He comes to be with her. And I believe that that is a great truth, a great truism. When, regardless of what this broken and damaged and unpleasant world does to us, when we take ourselves away and we hide in God's presence, he comes to be with us, however we choose to do that. And I would point out as well that Christ did just the same. Christ patterned and commanded frequently that we take ourselves off in prayer, that we be apart and with God. Anyway, finally, we come to some shocking final verses. Let me remind you of verses 59 to 63. On the eighth day, they came to circumcise the child, and they would have called him Zechariah after his father. But his mother answered, "No, he shall be called John." And they said to her, "None of your relatives is called by this name." And they made signs to his father, inquiring what he wanted him to be called. And he asked for a writing tablet and wrote, "His name is John." And they all wondered. It's shocking. It's shocking. Elizabeth doesn't have any say in what her kid is going to be called. They are about to name him Elizabeth, and she actually has to stop them and say, "Wait, I want to call my son something different by command of God." And when she has explained that, they take not the blindest bit of notice of her and go and ask Zechariah. And they give him a tablet. They used to have these wonderful little tablets that you folded in two, and they had hot wax on them. Well, not hot. The wax eventually cooled, but you had wax on it. You could write on it. Then you could heat the wax and start again. It was great for practicing writing. And that's what John wrote on. "His name is John." Sorry, wrote Zechariah. But I think it's, again, quite fascinating that Elizabeth isn't just saying this. She doesn't say, "I have a feeling that he should be called John." She doesn't say, "I would like his name to be called John." She doesn't say John's name, which means God is gracious. Seems to fit very well, and so that's what I want to call him. She's saying these words in the authority of God himself because of her experience of living faith. And with experience of living faith comes the authority given by God to declare words of his grace. Let me say that again. With the experience of living faith comes the authority from God to speak his words of grace. That is a crucial thing. And Elizabeth says it nice and clearly. His name is John. She has that authority. And the petty minds of those around that have not grasped or understood can't stand in the way. God doesn't let them, even though they try. So I want to say to you very simply this morning, be inspired by this woman of living faith. As I put at the bottom of the reading, a brief summary of these reflections. Living faith perceives there's a plan and a purpose. Living faith joins in with the plan and revels in it, even embodies it. And living faith has the authority to declare the plan. This living faith is something that is available to each and every one of us this Christmas time and any time. I pray that you will be blessed by reflecting on the story of lovely Elizabeth.